Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have a distinct perspective on time.
Andrew, this week you have on Maggie Doyne, who's the co-founder of Blink Now, a foundation in Nepal. What'd you talk about?
Well, so I should first mention that I learned about Maggie through Tina Eisenberg. So thank you, Tina, from Swiss Miss, who described one of the most inspiring people she'd ever met, which was this woman, Maggie, who I hadn't heard of at the time. And then I mentioned it to my friend John Benson, who said, oh, she's a good friend. Let me connect you. And just by chance, she happened to be in New York. She's in Nepal most of the year. She was visiting here. Very last minute, we got her in the studio, and I'm so happy we did because we can share her story. She exemplifies this idea that one individual with limited means can really just look at a problem and change it and affect the lives of many people. She's in her early 30s. She has been in that area since, I believe, her early 20s, and she has built a home and taken care of, basically mothered 54 children. She recently had her first child biologically, and she's built a school, a women's clinic, a sustainability farm, actually the greenest school out there. So she is just this extraordinary human being who's incredibly inspiring, and I'm just really happy that we have this platform to share these kinds of stories, which really need to be told.
Yeah, can't wait to listen to it. Here's Maggie with Andrew.
Today on Time Sensitive, we're honored to have Maggie Doyne in the studio. Maggie's an extremely inspiring person. She's the founder and CEO of Blink Now, a nonprofit that seeks to provide educations and caring homes for orphan children in Sirkat, Nepal. For her work, Doyne has been widely honored from the distinction as CNN's Hero of the Year in 2015 to the Unsung Hero of Compassion, which was presented to her by the Dalai Lama. Welcome to the studio, Maggie. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So before Nepal was in your consciousness, before you became a mother to over 50 children and built this extraordinary nonprofit with all of these amazing centers and outreach programs, you grew up in suburban New Jersey. What was your childhood like?
Yeah, definitely think about every stereotypical thing you think about suburban New Jersey girl. We do not have the best reputation at all.
My wife's a Jersey girl.
Oh,
I love Jersey.
There we go. Represent.
Yeah.
So I was one of three girls. I went to a public school, Mendham High School. I grew up on a cul-de-sac backing up to Patriots Path. I had a dog named Sophie and a trampoline in my backyard. I played soccer and lacrosse and just everything typical about suburban safety, security, not incredibly well off, so to speak, but definitely a product of privilege and getting to live a life in the suburbs where everything was safe and glorious.
And you got through high school with this sort of very normal upbringing, as you describe it. And then you didn't do the sort of normal path. What were you thinking when you were getting out of high school?
Well, everything about me actually was thinking college, college, college. It was just written right on my forehead. Everything I talked about, everything I worked for was all for college. And all of a sudden, the best way to describe it is that I woke up one morning and was like, why? Like, how am I going to make this huge investment of everything, of money I didn't even have, when I have no idea who I am on the inside and what I want to be and what my purpose here is? And so it was that question that led me to the path of just stepping outside of the bubble and of the box and of the expectation. Because as a kid in suburban New Jersey, you're told, get to college, get to the best school you can. It has to be a name school, and get on the fast track to success, and that was the way. And I have found that to be just not true, but I thought that it was. And taking a step aside of all of that was the scariest thing at the time. But I took a gap year. I signed up for a gap year program thinking that travel and getting outside of suburban New Jersey and seeing something different or experiencing a different culture would help me find that question that I was asking. And ultimately, I think it was just an emptiness of, like, you're driven for the SATs and to be a good lacrosse player. And
your time is not yours in a way. It's so American.
Yeah.
In Europe, people take gap years. It's sort of understood that you need a minute to figure out who you are at 18.
Mm-hmm.
But in this country, it's really not like that.
There's no rite of passage or time where you just stop and reflect and say, well, who am I? And what am I going to do when I'm here? And we expect to go spend $100,000 and figure it out by taking classes on a college campus. And it just, now it just seems like insane. But at the time, I thought that that was what I needed to do in order to find myself.
And what program did you find?
There was a program called LEAP Now, Lifelong Education Alternatives and Programs. And it had a little office in Princeton, New Jersey. And I signed up for my first semester in the South Pacific of scuba diving in the Great Barrier Reef of Australia.
Amazing.
And learning Buddhism on a Buddhist monastery and organic farming, working in a Fijian village. It was so mind-blowing and completely just about self-exploration and learning outside of the classroom.
And then what happened?
And then, so I was a babysitter growing up and I was a camp counselor and I knew I loved kids and I was really good with them. And I said, I want to work with kids somewhere. I talked to the program and they were like, we think we have the right place for you. And it was in northeastern India. And so I ended up traveling to northeastern India to a project called Ramana's Garden. And it was there that I started working with Nepalese refugee children and families.
Right at the sort of end of the Civil War.
Yeah, that's right. It was coming to an end. Things were very unstable. There was an armistice in about 05, 06, and that's right when I was there. So all of the Nepalese community was following the news and the events, and everyone had fled, and children in these refugee communities were sleeping under plastic, and you can't help but follow along and get caught up in that. And I didn't know where Nepal was, but when you meet the people and put a face to what was happening, it made me really want to go.
And what made you fall in love when you were there?
Well, initially, I met a friend, and her name was Sunita, and she was my age, and she'd left her village when she was about 8 or 9 years old. And so she just wanted to go back and see her village and where she came from. And the two of us, in our young adventure mode, we're like, well, let's go together. And she had questions about where she'd come from and why. And I told her that I would do the trip with her. And so we end up on a bus for 3 days and we get off the bus and there's just a footpath and we start walking and finding our way back to Sunita's village. And it was there that I fell in love, on this footpath in rural Nepal in the Himalayas. It was beautiful. It was completely off the grid, subsistence farming community, strong, resilient. Everyone who goes to Nepal just falls in love with the people. And so did I. But at the same time, you could see the effects of civil war and what it meant and what it looked like.
Displaced families, children who were really, really in need.
Yeah, and women, and the effects that it has on women and recovering from a civil war, and schools that had been shut down and homes that had been taken over by Maoist rebels, and children being forced to fight in a war that had nothing to do with them. And so it was interesting. That first trip was like this adventure of, like, let's go find Sunita's home. And we were harvesting rice and carrying water and all of the adventure that comes with going on a trek. but also an underlying realization of the struggle and what it means to be a child who loses your parents and is cold and hungry.
And then you met Hima.
Yeah. So we were on this riverbed, and I was in a trading post town called Sirket, which is further down and off of the grid of where we were, in this trading post city. And there's a riverbed, and as I cross the riverbed, I see a little girl, and she was among a few dozen kids breaking rocks. I mean, imagine coming across 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 8-year-olds picking up rocks and breaking them into pieces. It just stops you in your tracks. And I literally stopped on the road of this dry riverbed, and there were kids picking through garbage and breaking these rocks all day long.
In order to sell them.
Yeah. So they were selling them for gravel and making 100 rupees or $1 a day. And that was their existence. And they were happy, like smiling away and breaking their stones. And Hima looked up at me and she smiled and said, "Namaste, Didi." And at that point, I was aware of what was happening and was just like, okay, I can't do anything about 1 million kids or 100 million kids. But what if I could start with Hima? What could I make better about her life? And so she was the first girl who I enrolled into school.
So you enrolled her in school, which cost you?
It was like $28, a uniform, a backpack, a pair of shoes. I talked to the local school about enrollment and admission fees. It was really simple.
And she was living currently in an orphanage?
No. So this population of kids breaking rocks, like Hima had a single mom, and Hima could live with her mom and still does, and just couldn't get that barrier of, you know, all of those fees in order to get into school and needed the
passive. So you get Hima into school and then what?
So then it's addicting. This work is really addicting. And I start another girl, and I envision a day where I can walk over the dry riverbed and not see children breaking stone. And then I realize early on that that isn't totally enough. Like, kids get sick. Children don't have a safe place to live or a family or food. And so going to school is this distant dream and wish that's not always attainable. And I realized that for the kids in the most vulnerable population, that they also needed a home. And I started dreaming about a home base. And I hated orphanages. I hated them. I hated everything they stood for. I hated the word. And so I was like, well, let's just change it up a bit. And we're going to call this a home and we'll be family. And that's when I called up my mom and dad again. At this point, it's becoming a gap, 2 years, gap life. And I asked, hey, can you send me over my babysitting money? As a babysitter, I'd saved up about $5,000, and there was $5,000 of land for sale. And I thought, that's it. I'm going to build this home.
So interesting that you took the money you had made from childcare and reinvested it back in childcare.
That's true. I never really thought about it that way.
That's really struck me. It's like your life savings was from taking care of children, and you wanted to take that money to take care of more children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you buy this piece of land, which is, by the way, in and of itself, for a 19, 20-year-old person to buy anything, much less a piece of land in Nepal, is really unique. Were you at all concerned with, like, am I crazy? What am I doing? How much were you working on shaking off all the programming from your whole upbringing, from society, from kind of telling you this is not necessarily a normal thing to do?
At this point, I think this is where being 19 really, at the time, played a role, because I was just at the time, it felt easier for me to stay than it was to just turn around and go back and go to college and have that existence. So at that point, I just had that fire in my belly and the passion and the drive. And I the other thing is I didn't picture it being this grand, big scheme. It was just a little small part and something that I thought I could do. And then maybe I'd go back to school, or maybe I didn't know, but it wasn't. I think often people think I put a dot on a map and I was like, I'm going to go save kids. And it's not that at all. It was just like, I see this problem. We started working with the local community. I have an incredible Nepali co-founder named Tope, who was an orphan himself. And things at that point, just we became an unstoppable force. We're like, we're going to build this little home and I'll go back and babysit, because we ran out of money really early on after the $5,000.
And how many kids were living in the home?
Well, all we had was the property and a couple kids enrolled in school. And I went back and babysat, and I was just sending like 500, 700, whatever I could make.
You went home. All your friends are in school.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of alone.
Yeah. I visited a couple of them at college and did some jello shots and saw that they were pledging for sororities and fraternities. And I was like, this is not for me. This planet's not for me either. So there was a period where I just felt a little unsure. But yeah, ultimately, I just put my head down and I started reading and reading and reading and learning. And also being 19, I just knew I didn't have all the answers and I had to find people who did and study development and study how to do this work. And I was in the library all the time. And slowly but surely, I think we needed $2,800 for a septic tank, and I couldn't babysit my way. And that's when the seed got planted of, I did a garage sale and then bake sales, and the word started to spread. And ultimately I sat down and wrote bylaws and started the Blink Now Foundation, started talking to people and fundraising.
Oh, so you formalized it during that experience at home. And how long were you spending at home? How long was that trip?
I think that period was about like 5 months of just intensive study and work, and write my bylaws and wrote a bit of a strategic plan and sent. The home was slowly being erected brick by brick with the team back in Nepal, and they would take whatever I sent. My co-founder was doing the same thing, working and sending what he could, and little by little, the house went up, and then it became real and something people would start to send, $20, $500. And that was when we started the foundation.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And then you went back.
Yeah. And then I went back and put all of the finishing touches on. We, you know, painted it yellow and built the bedrooms, and I started working with the local government on assessing the needs and the first group of kids who would come into the home. Initially, we thought 3 or 4 or 5, really small children's home. And I think after the first year, we had about 15 kids.
And at this point, were you receiving any sort of negative pressure, the sort of, you know, that voluntourism kind of gets sometimes? Were they not welcoming you in any way? Were there skeptics?
No. So the voluntourism debate, I don't think it started until 2011, 2012. And at that point, it was just us as a team in Nepal and our Nepali team and just doing our thing and fulfilling a need and working with the government. And I think working in deep partnership and collaboration with the people. And yeah, my journey definitely started out as sort of that. And I have a lot of self-consciousness about that, of, you know, starting out as, you know, being a traveler who saw a need. But
yeah, but you've taken such a different approach to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not even close. It's you've collaborated and you've had humility in the process, which is, I think, of what's missing in a lot of the debate right now.
Yeah, yeah. But at the time, I mean, We were just doing our thing and so overwhelmed with the number of kids and cases. And then we launched the school, and I think we just had our heads down and we're doing the work and learning as we went. And
not worried about where you were going to get to, which is what I'm kind of so impressed by, is that it was a daily practice for you. You didn't have a grand plan of fixing something big. You just wanted to get through the week and get kids sort of into a safe place.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I think the thing I didn't expect was that I'd become as close with the kids as I did and that we did, and we slowly did become a family, and we just became a family just like any other family, and we had our struggles just like any other family, and we just became so incredibly close. And that's
because your main job was running a household just like any parent right now. Mm-hmm. Get the kids up, get them fed, get them dressed, get them to school.
We're going to raise these kids. Yeah, we're going to raise these kids. And
were you taking on a sort of any specific gender role in that, you and your partner, of a mother and a father, or how was that working out?
No. So my co-founder, he was working and living in India. That's where he was working. And so for the first 6 years, it was just me and another couple, actually Sunita's parents, who we ended up finding. And they were refugees and wanted to move back to Nepal. So they Amazing. Were auntie and uncle, and I was Maggie, mom. And it was sort of like a commune. We built a small home and a small family. And I wasn't even mom to begin with. I was just Maggie. And then slowly over the years, I became Maggie mom. And for the little ones who came in, I became mom. But it was never anything that was forced, or it just sort of happened. And I wasn't expecting that at all either, I thought.
Were you reading parenting books during this time?
Oh, yeah. Dan Siegel is my guru. And every parenting blog, every healing, you know, because the kids who come in also come with biological family who's passed, and grief and trauma, and not having, you know, not knowing where the next meal is going to come from. So we had to work through a lot of that and slowly build up a team of social workers and other aunties and uncles. And initially our whole staff had been orphaned themselves as well, and that really worked. And I wanted the kids besides me to see Nepali people. So yeah, it wasn't necessarily mother or father roles. It was building like a loving family commune, kind of. Just all of us working together. And the thing I read about children's homes is that kids grow up in these institutions and they don't have the skills that they need to make it and stand on their own 2 feet. So that was really important in the values. We grew our own food and we cooked meals together and everyone worked together as a family, and the older kids helped with the younger kids. And it was just like joyful. We played soccer and flew kites and read books, and it was just a joyful, loving family place with a swing set in the front yard and everything that I had been given as a kid. I just tried to replicate my own childhood in a lot of ways.
Amazing. And so you have this home, and then you build a school, the Coppola Valley School.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had first taken on sort of the domestic issues, and then now you were taking on education. How did you approach that?
Yeah, I think initially it was just get all of the kids who we were supporting, because a lot of kids like Hema, she didn't need to come and live in the children's home. She had a single mom and a really loving family, but she just couldn't get over that hurdle. So a lot of the kids we were supporting didn't come into the home. In fact, it makes up a very small percentage. And so it was initially like the vision of get everybody under the same roof. And kids needed medical care, clean water, a meal every day. Nutrition just became really huge. So the first year or two of launching the school was to make it full service and give them the support that they need outside of academics, because, again, basic needs are the most important thing. And then we started looking at building curriculum and hiring teachers and finding school leadership. And, again, we learned as we went along. We drew inspiration from other schools and other projects. We focused on the ethos of love and family and caring for the planet and caring for each other and reading and math and science. And the schools in the region were all practicing corporal punishment and hitting kids with sticks. And initially, again, like the orphanage debate, I was like, I can do better than that. Come on, like, I'm not going to have a school where kids get beaten when they don't know an answer. So it just started with, okay, really good, healthy, nutritious food, loving teachers, and making it a place where kids were safe. And then
yeah, you're leading with heart, not head entirely. You're really leading with an empathic approach, which is what was turning up such good results in a lot of ways. So you get the school going, then you get this lunch program going, and then a women's center. How did that come about?
Yeah, so we realized, you know, orphan care, it's very symptomatic. So just the word orphan, it means that a child has lost their parents, and it's wrong, and it shouldn't ever happen. And kids are losing parents to things that are preventative. And so one of the things we realized is that to get to the source of the issue, we really needed to start working with mothers and women. You know, suicide became the leading killer of women of childbearing ages in Nepal. And it seemed like the natural step. And we could only control the kids' well-being and safety and their education once they came inside the gates of the school. But if a child was experiencing violence or lack of food in the home, there was only so much we could do there. So it felt like the next step was to start empowering women. And we opened up a class to a class of women, and 70 women came, and we started training and sewing and seamstressing and training and doing a full empowerment course. And what we realized is that mothers can provide for their children when given, you know, the most basic things, that they just needed a little bit of training and an income source.
And then a clinic?
Yeah.
I mean, you keep reading about the things you've done, and to you it seems so obvious. Well, next we did this. But it's extraordinary, this trajectory of what you were able to build to fix these larger issues.
Yeah.
In a very small team.
We're raising a child, and you think about all of the things that your three kids need, and it's so multifaceted, right? It's love, it's their health, it's their wellness, it's their social well-being, it's after school activities and the arts and sports, and if you can uplift a child, you can uplift a community. And these issues surrounding poverty and development and post-war impoverished regions are so complicated. You know, like a kid can't come to school if they're just drinking dirty water and going to get sick, or not be nourished enough to make it to the age of 5, or have violence in the home that's inhibiting their ability to learn. So I look at it as an organism, and it's layered, and you can't just put a Band-Aid and fix one part of the issue. You know, I couldn't just enroll kids into school. It didn't address every issue. And so I started to look at going deeper, and just it happened naturally and slowly and organically, like I think all good things. And it happened with the help of experts and a team and us looking to address these issues really holistically. So one thing led to the next, and slowly we'd build on one another thing. And it was all surrounded by the concept of a whole child, and what does a whole child need to become who they're going to be, which we want our kids to become the next future leaders of Nepal.
And how were you finding the time to raise the funding to do this?
Oh, just pure hustle. I mean, the first couple years were really scary. And you're a mother, but you're also a CEO running now a foundation that's small and budding. And I was really young. And the first thing that happened that really set the course was winning Cosmo Girl of the Year. A friend of mine, a dear friend, Megan, put in my picture and submitted a short entry to Cosmo Girl magazine. And sure enough, a couple weeks later, I got a call, and the gal's name was Rachel, and she was in New York City here. And she said, "Congratulations, you've been selected as Cosmo Girl of the Year, and it comes with $20,000. And so she also told me that it got even better, and that I was also going to get a Maybelline makeover.
Which you were really looking forward to.
In Nepal, it's exactly what I needed, was some Maybelline. But sure enough, I flew to New York City. I had lice in my hair and had to get my hair done and the whole makeup and the fake eyelashes. But yeah, I was so bitter. It's just like, all I wanted was more bedrooms and, you know, to be able to pay the electricity bill.
Couldn't just take the $20,000 and bounce.
I know, It came with the deal. But ultimately, the piece came out. And what I realized is that those young girls across America didn't care about the makeup. They loved the story and they were inspired and they were starving for goodness and hope and that we can all do something to make the world better. And that set off sort of a chain reaction. I think later came Glamour. And then I was on the back of the Doritos bag, the Cool Ranch flavor. They gave us $100,000, which we used to build the school. Wow. And I started a blog and started sharing stories. And we just started the nonprofit hustle, which is what it is, of applying for grants and to family foundations and crowdfunding. We crowdfunded a school bus when we bought our first school bus because our kids were walking, you know, 2.5 hours to get to school. So, yeah, it just, you know, the nonprofit is an industry just like everything else. You have to connect with people who want to support your cause and make it real and say, look, for 25 cents, you can feed a child's school lunch and tell all of the good stories. Because also in charity, we just tell like the starving child story and orphan story. And we just don't do that. We say, look, our kids just won the national soccer championship. Look, like Aliza's up on stage reading poetry and she won the poetry competition. So I just really early on wanted to change that narrative and paint a really positive picture of these amazing kids because they are amazing. They're just like any other kids. And that's what we did.
Incredible. And I mean, it's so funny that you were able to sort of set your own kind of feelings aside and put this project first at all turns, which is, it seems, what how this has occurred, you know? So when you finished the clinic, the sustainable farm, you sort of got all this stuff together. It seems like this new wave occurred. And most recently, you have this new campus, and it's one of the greenest schools in the world. Tell me about how this occurred.
Well, our lease was going to expire. That initial $100,000 from Do Something and Doritos, it was a 5-year lease. And I thought, I just want to build a temporary school. Get the magic of a school happens on the insides. It's the curriculum, the teachers, the culture, the magic that a child feels when they enter the school. So the lease was expiring and we had to kind of figure out what we wanted to do next. And our school had grown and expanded and we needed to expand with it. So
how many kids are you at this point?
400. Yeah, not
every
a single...
day you're educating 400 kids and you're going home and how many kids are living in the house?
54. Yeah, we've transitioned a lot of kids now off at college and into apartments of their own. And it's been a new era.
And you're still living in the house?
Oh, yeah. I'm still there and still in it. We have other house parents with me because it's grown and a really strong Nepali team of caregivers. But yeah, we continue just to grow slowly and holistically. And the initial school we built was great, but it was bamboo and tin and just like shack of a school. And what was happening on the inside was magic. So we appealed to our team. We got a couple grants, a humanitarian award, and we bought a small piece of farmland just a couple miles up the road on the side of a foothill Himalayan mountain next to a beautiful temple.
In the same space that 15 years ago you showed up off a bus,
mm-hmm.
walking into town, the same small town.
Yeah, same, right there on the edge. And there was a beautiful Bodhi tree. And I was like, this is it. When we bought the property. And this time I said, if I want to build, I want to do it sustainably and ethically and with the world in mind. And this is in 2015 when all of the reports started coming out about the effects of the environment. And Sirket started to develop with the school, with the development there and after the Civil War and finding our way to democracy. And people were burning plastic and garbage. And I started just to worry about the environment and my kids' health and well-being. So we decided to build a green school. And it's completely self-sustaining. There's a rainwater harvest system that's genius, and the kids' biogas from the toilet turns into gas to cook food and run the Bunsen burners, and the water regenerates and filters through a reed bed system and then gets pumped back up to black water and gray water that's used to irrigate and clean. And there's solar panels, there's a solar cooker, the walls themselves are rammed earth because they're earthquake proof and also very low carbon and high embodied energy and maintain a perfect temperature. So that, with our team, became the project of the last couple of years, just building the kids a dream school.
Did you go to Bali to see the green school?
Oh, yeah.
I was there last week.
Were you?
Yeah, I just got back from it. And you walk through that and you think, this is extraordinary. Mm. This is such an amazing place. And then when I imagined, but of course, it's also a place of privilege and an expat community, essentially. And when I thought about what you were doing in Sirket, that this was not a sort of model to teach, but this was actually the way it's being done in a kind of a local place that is for the local children. I thought this is a very different approach to it.
Yeah, we're all about quality. Like, those kids who go to the green school in Bali, they deserve that education.
Absolutely.
And our kids who are orphan and vulnerable, they also deserve that school. And Paul Farmer says this best. He's like, if my mother was sick, would I send her to a substandard developing country hospital, or would I find the best treatment I could? And we have that same philosophy. These are our children, and they deserve the best schooling, the best quality possible, every privilege and advantage in the world. And that's a lot about the philosophy. That's why we go so deep in the community, and we feel like our kids deserve everything. And that's rare. It's hard to find that in the developing world and in countries like Nepal. A lot of times quality is sacrificed and, oh, like, they can have this quality or these cheap school, like the bad. And we just believe that these are our kids and they deserve everything. And that's what I want to see in the world, is like, how do we get it so that every child has that level of quality and access and privilege? Because the privilege, I've been thinking a lot about this because I just came back to New York and I'm here, and you do see privilege. And I was just in LA for Jeremy, and it's like, the privilege isn't the problem. The problem is that not everybody has access to the, like, not every, it's the spectrum, right? So,
and this idea of economies of scale, well, you know, privilege here is different than privilege there. No, privilege is the same. We should all have access to the same quality of life.
Basic needs and human rights. And we're talking clean water, high quality healthcare, access to education, safety, security, the chance to live and thrive and grow. And
while having care for the environment and our future.
Yeah, it seems so basic, right?
It seems so basic, but in this, like, late stage of capitalism, it's not. Mm-mm. And so it's one thing for there to be these incredible, sustainable schools in faraway places that you can leave New York and visit there for a year and enjoy. And it's a whole other for kids in Sirket who before didn't even have necessarily a school or home, but to get a similar experience that the kids of high privilege are getting.
Yeah. And there's this whole narrative of like, well, you deserve that because you work so hard for it, or, and your kids deserve a certain thing because you, but like, what's to separate? These are our kids. Like, we're a human family here. And
it's something you said when you accepted your CNN award. Mm-hmm. You said, we are one. These are all of our kids. Something that struck me quite deeply. How you must have been born in that perspective or brought into that perspective, but that's so unique in this day and age, and it's something we need so much more of, is an idea of oneness that's human. It's beyond gender. It's beyond race. It's beyond location.
And we're only as strong as our weakest. The thing is like, it's good for all of us to have our children cared for, because on a micro level, it's just the right thing to do, right? You see a child breaking rocks all day. You see a child growing up, you know, amongst violence and not having their basic needs. It's the right thing to do to care for children. But on the macro level, if we could just see that children not being cared for and safe has a direct correlation to like our GDP and, you know, global economics and war and violence and these cycles, and that the way to stop it is through taking care of our 4 and 5 year olds who are vulnerable. There's 165 million orphan children. We've figured out so much. We've sent people to the moon and outer space, and we've built these skyscrapers that we're looking at, and we just haven't figured out how to take care of a child, of our children on a massive scale. And that means that we have our priorities not set straight to me. That's what it tells me. And you can see that because we don't talk about it enough. You know, we don't talk about the fact that our children are hungry and dying
every day right now.
Mm-hmm. Look at what we talk about every day. You turn on the TV and it tells you everything about what our priorities are. And I hate doing this and preaching about it because I don't want to be.
No, but if we don't talk about it, it's not discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of us have earned a right to preach.
Thanks. But it's interesting because it's amazing to me how fast we get distracted and off track of what we need to have and where we need to go next, and to go back to the beginning, like who we're going to be and what we need to accumulate. And it's like, just when is enough enough? When can you say, you know what? This is enough. It's time for me to look after my fellow humanity. And that's the question that I'm wrestling with right now as I see children coming to us in numbers that we can't even begin to handle, you know? So I don't know. I don't have an answer.
Well, it's the discussion. It's the conversation. And it's the move right now from people sort of barking and selling to people actually discussing and figuring out problems. And I think we are moving into a place in the world right now of sort of the end of the age of the presentation and moving into conversation. And I think once mm-hmm. we move towards conversation, we're going to begin to solve things, because with conversation, the ego dissolves in a way, the individual dissolves and something larger occurs, which brings me to my next point that I've thought a lot about, which is, you spent your whole adult life, last 15 years pretty much, largely concerned with others. And that's taxing. At a certain point, it wears on you, I'm sure, to not sort of be concerned with the self for a moment. And I know that in 2015, there was a tragedy in your family that I know it's probably hard to talk about, but I did want to bring up within your story. You lost your youngest family member, Ravi, who was 2 years old. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear a little bit about that and then what happened in the aftermath and sort of what came after that.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Ravi is that he came to us when he was 2.5 months old. And he weighed about 3 pounds. He had lost his family and was a victim of starvation. And it just so happened, of all of the people in our project, I was at the gate one day when his older sister brought him in. So it was a really tumultuous journey. He was on death's doorstep when he came, and we were in the NICU and fighting this. The thing about starvation is that it's actually really difficult to address because the body's system shut down. So it was a really long journey. And it's so hard to explain in words, but Ravi became a happy, chubby little brother and son to me, and overcame every single obstacle that there was. And there was an accident one day and a gate was left open and he died in an accidental drowning. And it was just There's no words. It was horrific. And he was just the closest person to me in the whole world. And I had him 1 second on my chest and passed him off to a caregiver. And 10 minutes later, he was gone. And it was just like the world stopped, I guess. I was a caged animal. I wouldn't wish this on anyone, and it's incredibly difficult to talk about, but I couldn't function. I couldn't be a mom. I think my children lost their baby brother, but they also lost a piece of me that day. And ultimately, I had to come back to the States and get help and get support. And I thought that it was the end of me and the family. So, yeah, there was quite a few months there where it was darkness and I couldn't get out of bed and I needed a lot of help and also just to be on my own. And we're not okay. Like, it's still very raw and it's still very painful and we still don't feel like it's right and we miss him. But eventually I got myself out of bed and wanted to live again. And there was, after CNN Heroes, there was an event in LA at the Annenberg Foundation. And all of my best friends were like, you just need to get out. It was like snowy and freezing cold here. It was like February or March. And they were like, you need to get out. So to make a really long story short, I flew to California and I was like, I can't do a training. Come on. Like, and they were like, no, you need to try. Like my best friends, Rhoda and Libby, just try. And I go to this training. And then that night I went out and that was the night that I met Jeremy, who's now my husband. and I'd met him at the Do Lectures. It's this event and he'd given me his number and we had been kind of close friends, but it was in LA that we met up again just by chance. And I was like, oh, that's crazy. And it was a time when the scariest thing in the world was to love again. And then I went and fell in love and met this amazing man who's just instant love, soul connection is the best way to describe it. It was like we were meant to be, never left. We traveled back to Nepal together because, of course, we start dating and I'm like, well, the first thing you need to do is come to Nepal and see the kids and see what this is all about.
Meet my family. Yeah. You have to take him home to your family.
And he's a commercial. He makes like, he's a director. It's like in LA and he's Canadian and grew up on a farm and is one of six kids. So he got it. But his reality was very, very different when we met. Yeah. And then Jeremy and I fell in love and went back to the kids. And he ultimately helped me a lot through that journey of getting back to Nepal and being a mom again and getting back on my feet. And that was when I think it was a big test to the organization of just everyone really coming together as a team and getting through tragedy.
And that through tragedy, some sense of light is on the other end.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, my wish after being through this is
Well, you just proved it. I mean.
Mm-hmm, and you just want that for everybody. You just want that for anyone that goes through a hard time. Actually, my biggest fear was that I would die. Like, if not physically, that I would never be the same again. I would never feel joy again. And it was other moms who had been through it that said, you know, just you will feel joy again. You will be able, it'll never be the same, but just trust me, there will be something. And for me, it was Jeremy. We ended up getting married with all of the kids on the top of a Himalayan mountain. And I had like six flower girls and 20 groomsmen and 25 bridesmaids. All of the kids walked me down the aisle and he asked their permission first. And he fit. It was like he'd always been there. He fit so beautifully into the folds. And we got pregnant and had a baby, a biological baby named Ruby. And that's where we are now. I have a 16-month-old And
what was it like after having taken care of all of these children for 15 years to then be pregnant and go through all the other stuff that you hadn't experienced? It's as if you'd experienced parenting first before you'd actually been pregnant.
Yeah, it was interesting. At first I was really defensive because people would be like, oh, you're having a child of your own. And I felt like it kind of disregarded my role as a parent and a mother. And there was a lot of sensitivity. Like, even my kids were like, well, will you love this baby more because she's in your belly, like my little ones? And so I was very defensive about that. And I eventually talked to a woman who was an adoptive mother, and she's like, well, it is different. You know, you have to acknowledge that it is different. Mothering a child from your belly, that's just physiologically different, that one's growing inside of you and looks like you, and the others grew inside of your heart. And so it helped me to kind of navigate that after talking to other mothers who had been through it. And then it's just so gosh darn physical of having this baby inside of you. And eventually I thought, oh, I'm modeling for my kids too, because they're going to have biological children, I hope, some of them. And so it kind of helped me be less defensive and just say, I'm going to learn, I'm going to take this in. And I was scared that I wouldn't love her as much as I loved Ravi, because we were just so close. We were inseparable. I mean, he slept on my chest for a year and a half. And so it was, in some ways, it was the opposite for me. I was like, well, what if I don't love this baby as much as my others? And all of that, as you know, you're a dad, it's all just out the window.
Yeah, you don't have control of it.
Yeah.
You don't get to decide.
Just like, get this alien child out of me. And then you look at them and you go through this intense physical birth experience and you're looking at them, and that's the biggest life secret, is that it's just love and it's all real and it's different, but it's the same. And it's inexplainable and beautiful and magical and miraculous. And there's no sense in comparing it. Like, it's, you can't compare love to love. It just magnifies. And that was the lesson.
And expands.
It just expands. Yeah, it's so funny. Like, we think that love is this thing, like, you can only have so much of it. And if only we could crack that one. It's true. It just expands. And there's room for everything. There's more room.
And so now you're raising Ruby.
Yeah, in Nepal.
In Nepal with Jeremy.
And the kids.
And you're in a new phase of your life where everything's sort of shifting in terms of how you see time and how you see how you're spending your own time and the things that you want to achieve. And you're also starting new things. You're not slowing down, mm-hmm. which is something people, I think, often think they have a kid, or the more they take on, the less time they'll have. But it seems that you're only expanding more and more and more and almost just getting started.
Yeah, I'm 32 and I'm still like, I do feel like we're just getting started. And I also feel like the task at hand is so big. And when you do have a child and children, you realize the sense of urgency of like, I want this world to be better for these kids. And it's my obligation and my duty, and I won't stop until we can leave this place better and safer for my children and for our children and for the next generation. And so it just becomes bigger and bigger, and it does feel like a different era in a way. You know, we're running the foundation and the organization, but there's a team, and we're Nepali run. And as a founder and CEO in general, you have to start thinking about succession, which is a weird word when you're 32. But as a parent, I think you're always thinking about, can this, and this has to exist beyond myself. So it's that. But I have every intent on being around forever and doing this work until it doesn't need to be done anymore.
And you've recently started a new project with Jeremy. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah. So when Jeremy and I met, he was making like a shampoo and makeup commercial, and which you might know a little bit about.
I've made a few.
And gosh, the week we found out we were pregnant. He was on a makeup call, you know, just traveling back and forth to LA and trying to figure out how to get more makeup in the shot. And we also adopted two baby girls who were 9 months old and 2 years old. And he was kind of at a crossroads where he was like, all right, where am I going to be? And he had also been filming. Went from the day he came to Nepal, he'd had his little camera and he was taking portraits of the kids. And so we started a project called Love Letters. In my grief and in my loss, I started writing love letters to the children while I was away. And in my healing process, just to promise them that I was coming back, and I was working on it. And so that project is being turned into a documentary called Love Letters for My Children, which I can't wait to see.
Neither can I.
Jeremy's been filming and chipping away at that. And he started Empower, and just to tell more meaningful stories about our world and humanity and changing the dialogue of what we talk about and the stories we tell.
Well, I think what I want to end on is just that it's often thought that, you know, we all have a desire to help, or most of us have a desire to help, but we struggle with a number of things. One of them being how, you know, today, what will it matter? What can you leave us with? In terms of what you've learned about the idea of the individual and how the individual can have an effect on society at large.
It matters. Everything matters. Every step, every action. I think the reason why we're in the state that we are is because of thinking like, oh, it doesn't make a difference. But what's that quote? Like, a few dedicated people, I'm going to botch it, but like, us as a collective humanity, we matter. You matter. The stories we tell matter. Every step we take every day matters. And as soon as we start believing that this is possible, because we've gotten into a narrative that, like, it's too big, the problems are too massive, the scale, like, there's just no way we can do it. And as a result, we've put walls up. Okay, like, well, I'm just going to control what I can control and protect me, and that's really dangerous. And so I think we need to open up and say, we matter. We can do this. We have to believe in a world and see an end result where poverty, extreme poverty, is unheard of. And I have this vision of me being an old lady, gray, on my rocking chair, surrounded by all of my grandchildren, and my kids saying, like, really, Grandma, was there a day that people didn't have enough food to eat, that there was violence and kids weren't cared for? And I just invite everyone to have that vision, because we also are what we believe in and what we believe is possible. And just on a really practical how-to, like, look for the flare and the flicker of, like, whatever it is, the bees, the whales, plastic, pollute, like, there's so much to do, sadly. The oceans, like, there is so much to care about and so much to take action on. So I just tell young people, like, it doesn't have to be Nepal. You can adopt a bunch of kids, but you don't have to. Look for the little steps and the little things you can do, and also where your passion and your interest is, and then go for it, and take every step you can and start learning about it and getting involved in the little things. Enough of us doing all of the little things are going to create that tipping point that are going to get us to the end. And you said the shift is happening. World hunger has been cut in half. Like, we also have to remember that the world is getting better. It is. I know it. I see it. Enrollment of girls into primary school is the highest it's ever been in the whole world. That's going to have an effect. And
we need to hear more positive stories.
Oh, yeah. It is. The world is a better place than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And the UN is hitting their sustainable development goals slowly but surely. And enough of us waking up to them and working together towards these goals will make it. We'll do it.
We need to practice rational optimism.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of the Time Sensitive Podcast on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv.